This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Former President Jimmy Carter is now one of the most sought-after mediators in the world. In Haiti, he negotiated an agreement with the military rulers that averted a U.S. invasion. In North Korea, Carter helped defuse a nuclear crisis by getting assurances from leader Kim Il-sung that he would freeze their nuclear program and allow international inspections. More recently, Carter negotiated a ceasefire in Bosnia. His efforts have won much praise, but he's also been criticized for cutting favorable deals with dictators. Is he a stooge or a savior? Asked one Newsweek headline. In the first half of today's show, we'll talk with Jimmy Carter about his role as a mediator. Then in the second half of our show, we'll talk with him about his new role as poet, and he'll read from his new book of poems, Always a Reckoning. Jimmy Carter said that he gets calls almost every month asking him to mediate conflicts. I asked him what criteria he uses to decide if he will accept an invitation.
Well, the first thing is that we have to be able to induce both sides to accept our presence. Usually we get a request or an importunity from one side, and then we go to the other side and say, are you willing now for us to participate? Do you really want to resolve this problem in a peaceful way instead of through continued war or the eruption of war? That's the first step. The second step is to get permission or approval from my own government, either from the State Department or the White House. And in most cases, we are better able to get approval from the White House because the State Department is an enormous bureaucracy, and there is at least an insinuation in their mind that if some outsider comes in to address a problem, that it means that they have failed in their duties. So in most cases that have been highly publicized recently, we've had approval from President Clinton and some of his subordinates, but some opposition from other places within the government.
How often has the president turned you down when you've requested the opportunity to mediate?
Well, it's not only this president, but others as well. For instance, in the case of North Korea, we were asked for 3 years by then-President Kim Il-sung to come to Pyongyang to listen to their position and to try to resolve the increasingly challenging differences between North Korea and the United States. And when we asked for permission to go, or approval from the administration, both under President Bush and President Clinton, they said no, that it was not an appropriate time or it was too sensitive an issue for us to handle. 3 years before we went, also in Haiti, when President Aristide was forced out of office by the transitional government, later headed by President Emile Jonassin and by General Cedras, both the expelled President Aristide and the provisional government leaders who remained in Haiti asked the Carter Center to perform the services of a mediator. But for 3 years, both our own government and the United Nations said that our services were not needed. So we didn't go in either case, in North Korea or in Haiti, until the crisis erupted and war was imminent. In the case of Bosnia, we were asked to go to Bosnia by the Serb leaders who wanted permission to send a delegation down the plains to my home to talk to me. There, I called President Clinton, told him about this request. He approved it. They came to my home, explained what they would do if I would come to Bosnia and listen to their side, and I again got permission from the White House to go.
Now, what did the Bosnian Serbs say to you that made you take them seriously? I'm asking this in the context of knowing that Karadzic has basically reneged on nearly every agreement that he's made.
Well, he said that if I would come, he was prepared to open up relief convoys, deliveries. He was willing to open up the airport in Sarajevo. He was willing to exchange prisoners of war, and he pledged to honor human rights. And so I relayed this information, as I said, to the White House and also to the State Department. And I told him that I would only come if he demonstrated tangibly that these things were being done. And I didn't go into Bosnia until all these things were put into effect. And then I went both to Zagreb in Croatia to meet with President Tudjman and also to meet with President Izetbegović and his associates and the Bosnian government before I went to Pale to meet with the Bosnian Serbs.
When you know that someone who you're about to negotiate with has violated all the promises they made in the past, how does that affect the way you handle the negotiations and the way you handle a promise that they're ready to make or a treaty that they're ready to offer?
Well, quite often we find that both sides violate agreements.
Mm-hmm.
And that the media coverage in our country is quite biased. We tend to have heroes and villains, and the heroes can do no wrong and the villains can do no right. What we do at the Carter Center is analyze all the world's conflicts. There are about 32 major wars now, and we try to learn on a sustained basis the causes of those conflicts, the people involved, the issues that must be addressed, and so forth. And almost invariably, these wars are civil wars within a country. And except on rare occasions where the United Nations Security Council has actually acted, it's not proper at all for a UN official even to talk to a revolutionary who's trying to overthrow a government that's a member of the United Nations. So we go where others don't want to go. And at the time we went to North Korea, there was actually a law in effect that prevented any American from going to Pyongyang to talk to the officials there. And as you know, we were on the verge of a mass invasion of Haiti when we went down to Haiti. So we try to keep an open mind, not condoning what has been done in the past, but setting up the procedure so that at the end of the mediation process, both sides win. If one side wins and the other side loses, then there's no way that an agreement can be preserved. I might say that in the case of North Korea, although there was extreme doubt about any possibility of resolution of the issue peacefully, everything has turned out beautifully so far. And in the case of Haiti, of course, we've had an almost bloodless way to restore democracy, and the American forces are now withdrawing in a very beautiful fashion. What's going to happen in Bosnia, I think it's too early to tell.
Well, the headline in the New York Times today is about how the ceasefire is fraying.
Well, the ceasefire is fraying on both sides. When I was there, there was an agreement reached with President Izetbegović, the head of the Bosnian Muslims, that they would withdraw from the demilitarized zone just adjacent to the Sarajevo airport. That was to have been done before Christmas. It still has not yet been done. Also, there is fighting around Bihać in the northwestern corner of Bosnia-Herzegovina that involves the Bosnian government forces and also Croatians and also some breakaway Muslims who are fighting against the Bosnian government Muslim forces. So it's an extremely complicated situation, and I think we're going to have to be somewhat patient and pray that both sides will see the efficacy of moving toward peace in spite of inevitable setbacks. If you look at the headlines day by day, you'll see they go up and down. And we try to stay in touch with both sides in Bosnia, indirectly through the United Nations primarily.
When you went to negotiate in Bosnia, Leon Panetta, the White House chief of staff, put it like this. He said, "The Serb motives are suspect." And I'm certain many people agreed with him when he said that. You know, a lot of skeptics say that tyrants ask you to come because they think they'll get a better deal out of you. So what do you say to that?
Well, I don't have any deals to offer. And I never go without the approval of my government. And I never deviate from the policies of my government. And I'm not only very familiar with the reasons and background and personalities involved in conflicts, but I'm also very careful that I'm thoroughly familiar with my own nation's policy before I go into an arena of this kind. I've never deviated from that. Also, I don't want any authority. I have zero authority. I just go as a private citizen, as a professor at Emory University, as a member of the Carter Center. And this is very important to me. When I conclude any sort of agreement, it has to be approved word by word with the authorities in charge. both sides to a dispute, or in this particular case, by the United Nations representatives there, and also by my government. And for instance, when we negotiated at the last minute after an attack had already been launched against Haiti, every word in the agreement that I worked out there with Emile Jonassin, the provisional president, was approved by a group of people in the Oval Office, including the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and a national security advisor. So I don't want any authority. I don't need any authority. I don't have anything to offer. I try to represent the Carter Center well and make sure that everything I do is completely compatible with the policies of my government.
Let me ask a question that I'm sure a lot of people have wondered about. You have such a strong human rights record. What is it like for you to sit opposite someone like Karadzic, knowing the war crimes that he's guilty of? Is it more difficult for you to negotiate with somebody who you think of as a tyrant?
Well, there are two or three phases. One is the preparation for it. And the second phase after I get there is an extensive listening process. I have to listen to their position and understand them. And then I weigh in with basic demands. My rationality, if I need any of it, is that if a war is going on, we terminate the war. If a war is imminent, as was the case in Haiti and North Korea, we try to prevent the war. If terrible human rights violations have occurred in the past, we try to make an environment possible within which the human rights violations will be totally eliminated or dramatically reduced. And I think that's a standard that we fill. And whether someone has been guilty in the past of starting a war or committing human rights atrocities is obviously a very serious matter for us to consider, but we try to end those practices and bring peace and the alleviation of human rights suffering.
Do you have to enter negotiations with someone who is a tyrant in a fairly non-judgmental way and be as cordial and open as you possibly can?
Well, I'm cordial and open. The only thing I have to offer is my own integrity and an element of objectivity. I don't have any axe to grind. My axe is to try to bring peace and an end to human rights abuses. But it doesn't mean that I go in ignorant of past crimes. And I have to just realize that these people have committed crimes. In most cases, crimes have been committed on both sides. They may be much more onerous on one side than the other. But quite often it's the scorned person or the despised person or the unsavory people in international judgment that will need someone to listen to their position, as was the case with Kim Il-sung and with the provisional government in Haiti and as with the Bosnian Serbs.
Former President Jimmy Carter is my guest. He's written a new book of poems, which he'll read from later in the program. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jimmy Carter. I want to ask you about something that was reported in the papers after you returned from Bosnia. There were reports that you made a couple of gaffes, that you mispronounced some Slav names, and that you called the Bosnian Serbs Serb Croats in one of your conversations. And a West European diplomat who preferred to go unnamed said, your gaffe served a purpose. And he said, quote, because Jimmy Carter appeared so naive, so ignorant, the Serbs started to relax. Nobody else has been able to do that. Carter got them to relax, unquote. Would you comment on that?
Yes. In the first place, if I had learned how to pronounce all the Slavic names before I went, I never would have gone. Some of these names are very difficult for me. For instance, the president of Bosnian government, Izetbegovic. It took me a while to learn how to say that without faltering, and Karadzic, I knew that I had to pronounce Dr. Karadzic's name before I went. There's still some dispute about how do you pronounce it, where do you put the accent. But that's, I think that's frivolous. If I said anything about Croatian Serbs, I don't know that I did or not. That was obviously a slip of the tongue. But I go there not as an ignoramus. I'm not foolish or naive. I'm not stupid. I go there with a lot more knowledge about these conflicts and the background than is generally accredited by some of the observers in Europe and in this country. And the bottom line is that I'm very careful about my nation's policy, and the final approval of any agreement I worked out has to be turned over to those in authority. And to repeat myself, I don't have any authority, and I think it would be damaging or restraint on me if I did go as a U.S. ambassador or as an official representative of the Secretary General of the United Nations. I think that this would mean that my own flexibility, my own ability to arouse trust among these people would be reduced or aborted.
When you went down to negotiate with the leaders of Haiti, American warplanes were being launched during the final stages of your negotiations. What went through your mind in the last few minutes? You were aware of the fact that the planes were on their way?
No, not. I didn't know that the attack was going to take place Sunday evening. I thought it was going to be on Monday evening.
So you thought you had more time than you did?
I thought I had a lot more time until one of the Haitian generals came charging into the room and said that Senator Sam Nunn and General Colin Powell and I were liars and had betrayed their country. Here we were keeping all the generals and senior colonels in a room while American forces invaded Haiti. And it was only then that I realized that the planes were on the way. At that time, we were waiting in the room for the White House to get approval of the words that we were mediating from President Aristide, who was nearby and was being importuned to approve them. So this was a very serious matter. The square in front of the military headquarters was filled with thousands of increasingly fervent people who were chanting and demonstrating and singing. And that was a very critical moment because the planes, I understand, after I got back home, had been in the air for 75 minutes before we actually got out of Haiti, before they were turned around, as a matter of fact, when we reached an agreement with Acting President Jonathan.
So what was the scariest moment for you?
Well, I think that was it because we were, I would say, at the mercy of the Haitian military. We were guarded by just a few Secret Service agents, and the Haitian military were keeping the crowd back. And if the Haitian generals had ever said, you know, we are not going to protect these guys anymore because they betrayed our country, we would have may have been in trouble. What I did was induce them to make one more last effort by going across the square to the presidential palace, where we met with the aging acting president, a provisional president. He called himself Emile Jonassin. He was in his early 80s. He was a chief justice of the Supreme Court. He's the author of that Democratic Constitution. And when we got over there to meet with him, he said, we will go with peace. And soon after going back and forth with President Clinton in the Oval Office and back and forth with Emile Jonassin, we signed the agreement, and then we left, and the American forces came in peacefully.
Are there things that you can do as a mediator that a president or his staff cannot?
Sure.
What?
Well, there's a severe restraint on me when I was president and others of diplomatic niceties. And it's not appropriate even for the U.S. ambassador in Port-au-Prince to communicate by an exchange note with the provisional government leaders in Haiti when President Aristide was in exile. So that's when I can go in, and without any restraint on me, official restraint as a private citizen, I can talk to these people, listen to them, and deal with them. The final conclusion of the agreement in Haiti was not worked out with General Cedros. It was worked out with the foreign minister, whose name was David, and also with Emile Jonassin. And their actions quite often were contrary to what the military wanted. But the point is that as I said earlier, in these civil wars, our government can only deal with the official government. And the official government in Haiti was President Aristide. And in Korea, the official government was the one in Seoul. And now, of course, things are changing. We've now recognized North Korea as a separate legitimate entity, partially as a result of my trip there. And we're opening up intersections, and I hope we'll soon have normal trade and commerce and even full ambassadors exchange.
If you were able to turn back the clock and have the knowledge and the experience as an international mediator that you have now, would you have handled the hostage negotiations with Iran any differently?
No, I tried. You know, through every possible means, official and unofficial means, I tried to negotiate with or to communicate with the Ayatollah Khomeini. But he issued orders in his autocratic way that no Iranian was authorized to speak to anyone who represented the U.S. government in the hostage thing. So we tried to get all kinds of people to open up some sort of discussion with the Iranian officials to get our hostages out, and it was fruitless until the last few days of my presidency. The last 3 days that I was president, I never went to bed at all. I never even went over to the White House. I stayed in the Oval Office to negotiate with the Iranians indirectly through the Algerians, and it was that negotiation that finally brought about the release of the hostages. From 10 o'clock that morning until noon, when I went out of office, they sat in an airplane at the end of the runway in Tehran Airport. And as soon as President Reagan was sworn in, the plane took off. But that was a result of a last-minute negotiations through the Algerians.
Do you get a lot of requests from inside America, labor negotiations or other disputes?
Well, yes, we do. And this started after Camp David. When I left Camp David, I was inundated with requests from different people to resolve strike threats and so forth. And one of the intriguing things is, before I ever went to Bosnia, I discussed the possibility of the Carter Center adding its services to resolve the baseball strike. But I don't think that both sides, the owners and players, want to have a resolution of their differences enough to compromise even slightly.
Jimmy Carter. He'll be back with us in the second part of our show to read from and discuss his new book of poems, Always a Reckoning. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jimmy Carter. The former president has done something few presidents have had the talent, inclination, or nerve to do. He's published a book of poems. It's called Always a Reckoning. His poems won't be as controversial as his crisis intervention, but they reveal a side of him you wouldn't know from his role as a public figure. We asked him to read some poems and to talk with us about them. What do you think the assumptions are that people make when they hear a former president is also a poet?
Well, I think it's been a rare thing in history to have a president who was a published poet. I imagine a lot of folks that have been in the White House have written a poem or two.
And hid them.
And hid them, yes, or shared them with maybe a wife on Mother's Day or something of that kind. But I think to write poetry seriously is probably considered to be incompatible with being a politician who's been in the White House.
Why? Why incompatible?
Well, it's just not something that's been done in the past except a couple of times in ancient history. And my own background, of course, is in engineering and nuclear physics and not in literature. But I think people sometimes underestimate the interest that even politicians can have in the finer things of life, including poetry. I've been a poetry lover all my life, and I'm kind of an expert on some poets' works. But I think the general reaction would be, well, they'll be extremely amateurish, or they'll just be frivolous or
inspirational or calls to patriotism.
I think so. But I think in this particular book, I put together about 45 poems and tried to make them as diverse as I could in their character.
Well, let's have you read a poem, if you don't mind. And I'd like you to read a poem called Of My Father's Cancer and His Dreams. And you're welcome to introduce this if you'd like or to just begin the poem. But I think it would be nice for you to tell us first when you wrote it.
I've written most of these poems in the last 5 years, and what I've done ordinarily is revise each poem maybe a dozen or 20 times, trying to simplify them, make sure we had the right word and that the words were juxtaposed properly and that the lines either rhymed or didn't rhyme. In this particular poem, there are kind of slant rhymes. They're not direct rhymes, but I think the listener can probably detect them. This one is a poem about my father's last days. I was a submarine officer working under Admiral Rickover, developing the second nuclear submarine in history. And my father, I learned, was dying. And I went home to be with him. And I've tried to put myself in the position of someone who is in his or her last days on a deathbed and how they might react to the world around them. The name of this poem is Of My Father's Cancer and His Dreams. With those who love him near his bed, seldom speaking anymore, he lies too weak to raise his head but dreams from time to time. In one, he says, he sees his wife, so proud in her white uniform, with other nurses trooping by, their girlish voices aimed to charm the young men lounging there. Then her eyes met his, and hold, a country courtship has begun. They've been together 30 years. Now she watches over him as she tries to hide her tears. All his children are at home, but wonder what they ought to say or do, either when he is awake or when he seems to fade away. They can't always be on guard, and sometimes if his mind is clear, he can grasp a whispered phrase never meant for him to hear. He just seems weaker all the time. I don't know what else to cook. He can't keep down anything. He hears a knocking on the door, voices of his friends, who bring a special cake or fresh-killed quail. They mumble out some words of love, try to learn how he might feel, and then go back to spread the word. They say he may have faded some. He'll soon give in to the rising pain and crave the needle that will numb his knowledge of a passing world and bring the consummating sleep he knows will come.
Have you read that poem? Did you read that poem to your family before publishing it?
All my family are dead. I read it to Rosalind.
I was thinking of Rosalind.
But my father and my mother and both my sisters and my brother have all died with cancer. And so I don't have anyone to read it to except my wife, who's a very good editor and who is familiar with all these poems.
My guest is Jimmy Carter. He'll read more of his poems after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with former President Jimmy Carter, he's written a new book of poems called Always a Reckoning. In your dedications in this book, you dedicate the book in part to your father, who, let me turn to the page actually so I can quote it. You write, "To my father, Earl, who labored all his life but also loved the good times, his innate goodness curbed by the southern mores he observed, a man who relished discipline, who reached out to his son with love, always tempered with restraint." What were the southern mores he observed that you were referring to there?
Off separate but equal, mm-hmm. off discrimination against African-American neighbors. Although he wouldn't have put it in those terms, he would not have thought it was discrimination.
Did you ever try to change him on that? Do you think it's possible for a son to change a father?
Well, those were times. My daddy died in 1953.
So you were still pretty young.
I was in the Navy, and I remember once I came home from a submarine cruise, and I was bragging on the fact that we had been to Jamaica, and the Governor General of Jamaica had invited our submarine crew to come to a ball or party where young Jamaican women would be there. And then he discovered that one of our crew members was black. And the Governor General sent word back that everyone could come except that one crew member. And the crew took great pride in telling the Governor General to go to hell. And when I came home and told my father that story with some pride, he was embarrassed by it. And my mother said that I shouldn't discuss race issues with my daddy. But those were times, it's hard to remember now historically, when there was really not much question in the South of the advisability of a totally separate but equal society. And I don't think it's proper to condemn my father in ancient history because he complied with the mores of the time.
In your dedication, you describe your father as a man who relished discipline, physical discipline?
Yes. He relished discipline. He was very stern with me. He was very demanding of me. If I disobeyed him, the consequences were severe.
Like what?
Whipping.
Now, if people now say that, you know, whipping like that is like physical abuse against children and parents shouldn't do it. What do you think?
Well, you know, my three boys who came along quite a long time ago, they got some spankings. Amy came along 15 years later. She never got a spanking. And
was it because she was a girl or because the times had changed?
I think both. The times changed. Also, I don't think she ever deserved one. But I don't think my children would whip my grandchildren as my father did me and my sister. And those were the times. In school, you know, if we violated the rules of Plains High School, we got a whipping at school from the principal, a very official whipping. And when I got home, I got another one from my daddy. But he was a firm disciplinarian. And I wrote a couple of poems about him. He reached out to his son with love, but love always tempered with restraint.
Okay, it's time for another poem.
Okay.
I have another request.
All right.
This is called Itinerant Songsters Visit Our Village.
All right.
And it's really a poem about poetry and writing poetry and learning to write poetry.
This is really what precipitated my getting serious about writing poems. Some famous poems came down to Plains to do a reading, along with a country music singer, Tom T. Hall. One of these poets was Miller Williams, who wrote the textbook used in most colleges called How Does a Poem Mean?
Do you know, by the way, let me stop you here, that his daughter, Lucinda Williams, is a wonderful singer and songwriter?
She is great.
Yeah,
yes.
I was wondering if you liked her music.
I do. I have two CDs by her, and I was very pleased when she won one of the top Grammy Awards this past year.
Yeah, right.
I'm very
right.
pleased with Lucinda. Yes, I'm glad you know that.
That's yeah.
But Miller Williams has been a lot of help to me. But this is a poem about their coming to Plains. It's called Itinerant Songsters Visit Our Village. When some poets came to Plains one night, two with guitars, their poems taught us how to look and maybe laugh at what we were and felt and thought. After that, I rushed to write in fumbling lines why we should care about a distant starving child. I asked how we might love the fear and death of war, rejecting peace as weakness, how a poet can dare to bring forth out of memory the troubled visions buried there, and why we barely comprehend what happens out in space. I found my words would seldom flow. And then I turned to closer, simpler themes, a pony, mama as a nurse, the sight of geese, the songs of whales, a pasture gate, a racist curse, a possum hunt, a battle prayer. I learned from poetry that art is best derived from artless things, that mysteries might be explored and understood from that which springs most freely from my mind and heart.
I like this poem a lot, and I like how you describe in the poem you trying to, you know, write about great themes, war and peace and troubling visions, and then you turn to specific details and very specific things that happened to you. Tell me more about how you learned to do that in your poems.
Well, I was fumbling around trying to say great things and try to emulate famous poets, and I was having a lot of difficulty. The poems didn't quite come together, and then kind of a breakthrough occurred, and I found, as I said in the poem, that my words would seldom flow, and then I turned to simpler things about matters that really meant a lot to me. One of the poems that's my favorite is this sighting of a flock of geese that flew over the White House when I was living there, and how in a submerged submarine, we would hear the song of whales on our sonar, and how a visit to a pasture gate behind our barn was a turning point in my life on the race issue. those simple things that meant so much to me, it became possible for me to express perhaps profound ideas and feelings and thoughts using a simple theme as a vehicle rather than a complicated theme.
Did Miller Williams give you advice about that too?
Yes, he did. Most of my poems are factual, and Miller used to kind of make fun of me because I would be factual in my poems. He said, "Forget about exactness. It's the words and the thought that means more." But he used to tease me because the poems about myself are pretty well factual.
Jimmy Carter is my guest. He's written a new book of poems. He'll be back with us in a minute. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jimmy Carter. He's written a new book of poems called Always a Reckoning. When you're president of the United States, you're the most, important person in the country, and you have the most power and so on. And then when, fairly late in life, you start writing poetry more seriously than you ever wrote it before.
Yes.
I mean, you're getting started, pretty late with that and everything. There might be this feeling, well, how could I possibly be any good? And as former president, I'm only allowed to do things that I can really excel in. Did you ever go through a crisis about that and think, like, if you wrote poems, they'd better be the best poems, otherwise you wouldn't be able to measure up to your own standards?
Well, I did, and I have to say that I approached it fairly tentatively. I didn't just all of a sudden decide I'm going to write a book of poems.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a few poems, and then I submitted them to magazines and to quarterlies around the country.
Anonymously?
Well, I would put Jay Carter on them, and they would ask the publishers not to reveal the fact that they came from a former president, not to mention that at all. And then there were, very helpful critical reviews, most of them, by the way, favorable, I have to say. And so I increased in my confidence with experience. And finally, I decided to take about 45 of my poems and to put them together in this book.
Well, did you get rejection slips from anybody?
Yes, a few.
Now, did that hurt a lot?
Not really, because I didn't expect very much at the beginning. I expected to be rejected, and when I did get an acceptance, it was a very pleasant surprise. I submitted a few poems to some of the more prominent magazines, and the first time I sent a few poems to my present publisher, he said that he didn't think that a poetry book was appropriate for me. And I took one of the poems out of the New Yorker magazine that I could not comprehend at all, and I sent it to him, Peter Osnos. He says he has it on his wall in his office, but it's a totally incomprehensible, ugly collection of words that has no meaning to me, no rhythm, no rhyme. The words are not even good, but it was published in the New Yorker magazine, and I don't understand that kind of poetry. So, I went through a laborious process of finally saying, okay, I'm going to publish the poems that I like. I'm going to let them be truly expressive of my inner feelings, and if people like them, fine. If they don't, okay. So far, the reviews have been quite favorable.
Now, here's another problem I could see you being up against as a former president who writes poetry. I mean, poetry is something very personal, especially if it's first-person poetry, if it's about your life as opposed to just looking outside and reflecting on nature or whatever. And as a president, it seems to me you really have to withhold a lot of who you are and what's in your heart, because it can get you in a lot of trouble.
Yes.
I mean, some of the best poetry is very dark about human character and very complicated about human emotions. And poems that are dishonest and try to make things nicer than they really are usually not good poems.
Well, there are a few negative poems in here. One is With Words We Learn to Hate. And there are others as well. I need not go down the list, but I tried to express in here some of the things that concern me about public life.
There's another poem I'm going to ask you to read called Difficult Times.
Okay. It's a very brief poem. That's the title of Difficult Times. I try to understand. I've seen you draw away and show the pain. It's hard to know what I can say to turn things right again, to have the coolness melt, to share once more the warmth we've felt.
Was that a poem to Rosalind?
Yes, when we were having some difficult times. And that first version of the poem is not this one. I rewrote it several times to simplify it and to abbreviate it. But I think we all go through those things, and there's a reaching out to someone else that can be expressed in poetry that can be expressed, at least by me, in prose or verbally.
So did you give her the poem after you wrote it?
Yes.
Did that help
We got along
warm
right.
things up?
Well, we're still...
We're still together.
we're now approaching our 49th wedding anniversary, so yes, it did.
Now, this is an example of a poem that I would expect you might have reservations publishing if you were in the White House. Because then I could see all the press coming and saying, well, what was the dispute about and how long did it last? You know what I mean? And it just kind of being measured and interpreted in a way that was... Both very literal and very, much like the character issue as opposed to as a poem.
I don't think I could have possibly published these poems, you know, while I was still in the White House or even tried to.
And tell me why.
Well, they're too self-revealing.
Mm-hmm.
And they open up questions that I don't think ought to be explored in a White House press conference. I don't mind exploring them with you because I can kind of be evasive if I want to.
And that's no comment on my skills as an interviewer, right?
That's right. You're a very good interviewer. But I, obviously, this is something that couldn't be done. If I couldn't have had time to write them when I was in the White House. These poems took a lot of work. 5 years off and on of hours and hours and hours of struggling with a line or with a word or with a concept. And they're the product of a great deal of self-examination.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, I've enjoyed it. Thank you again.
Jimmy Carter's new book of poems is called Always a Reckoning. He says he's learned a lot from poet Miller Williams and enjoys the music of Williams' daughter, Lucinda Williams. We'll end the show with her Grammy-winning song, I'm Terry Gross.